Welcome to the Game Changers podcast, where we have clinical conversations that impact your pharmacy practice. Let's listen in as our team discusses this week's clinical practice game changer.
Hello and welcome to Game Changers Clinical Conversations. I'm your host, Jeff Wall, professor of pharmacy practice at Drake University. Today, again, a little bit off the beaten path of what we usually talk about, but it was a fascinating paper that just got published in The Lancet a couple of weeks ago that looked at emergency contraception. And looking at what in the United States is called Plan B, levonorgestrel, and looking at the addition of a non-steroidal to improve the efficacy of it. And that, when I read that byline, I was kind of like, what? But again, this is an area that's certainly not an area of expertise of mine. So it was, you know, so I did some reading on this. I was kind of surprised about that. So before we get into this, you know, I really want to sidestep all the politics associated with emergency contraception. We're going to talk a little bit today about, the incidence and how much the increase of use of EC has been in the last several years. And we're going to talk a little bit about how it works. Again, not so much because I don't think the listeners understand, but because, you know, when patients are talking to you or patients are approaching, for example, a community pharmacist and asking for this, you know, and they have questions, I think knowing about this is kind of important. So again, let's, you know, hopefully you can dodge any politics or you know, the pro or con from other reasons. We're just going to talk about the efficacy of emergency contraception to prevent unwanted pregnancy after unprotected sexual intercourse, a sexual assault, or other recognized contraceptive failure, such as a condom breakage or something along those lines. So that's what we're going to focus on. The paper that was in The Lancet was done in Hong Kong, and we're going to talk about some of the pros and cons about that as we come along here. Again, looking at the kind of statistics of it, it's kind of interesting. We've had emergency contraceptives, in particular Plan B in the United States for over 20 years. And if you take a look at the stats associated, up at 2019, we had 28% of women ages 15 to 44 who had ever had sex with a male had reported use of emergency contraception at least once in their lives. I'll be honest, that was a far higher number than I would have expected. But that number is, of course, higher than when it first came out in the early 2000s, where it was only 4%. So I think as people have become more aware of this and they know this is an option, it's certainly been used more. I think as we become more aware of the safety associated with this, that's been good as well. As you might imagine, it's mostly younger women who tend to report its use. And if you take a look at cohorts in general, you know, it depends on different ethnicities. But bottom line is the use of oral emergency contraception is, again, more common than I certainly thought. So in the United States, Plan B is a single dose of 1.5 milligrams. Levonorgestrel, which is taken within 72 hours of unprotected sexual intercourse. There's some other ones as well, the Lupristal acetate, which is given within 120 hours of unprotected sexual intercourse. But Plan B is certainly the most common one you're going to see. Remember that emergency contraception is only effective when given before but not after ovulation, and because it works by preventing pregnancy by blocking or postponing luteinizing hormone surge, thus disrupting the ovulatory process, but its effect is limited to its administration before the onset of luteinizing hormone surge, but not after that has occurred. And so, of course, that's why you have the kind of the time factor, because at that point, it's when intercourse is happening during the luteinizing hormone surge is when pregnancy is most likely to result. So how this medication works is then it basically lowers the ability to block ovulation and prevent fertilization. Once the ovulatory process has been triggered by luteinizing surges, it really can't work at that point. So the bottom line is that, you know, again, without getting too much into the weeds about this, it is not an abortifacient, and it basically just helps prevent this luteinizing hormone surge and basically kind of interrupts the ovulatory process. It has no effect on sperm function, fertilization, or implantation. So let's kind of get that out of the way. So the big question mark here, of course, is non-steroidals help with this? And I wouldn't have thought that. So though the studies show that, of course, prostaglandins do facilitate several reproductive processes, including ovulation, fertilization, tubal function, and embryo implantation, it is then thought for a long time that it's possible that blockade of the COX enzyme might actually act at least synergistically with oral emergency contraceptive methods. And there have been some preclinical studies that had suggested that, you know, studies in animals and stuff that have suggested that it did work not by itself, you know, which of course that kind of stands to reason, but working with emergency contraceptive hormonal methods to increase its efficacy. Several of the previous smaller studies have been published taking a look at this, and there was actually a 2016 meta-analysis that looked at all this and basically found that the data was kind of inconclusive, largely because they used different non-steroidals, things like melacoxib, celecoxib, which are you know, of course, more specific COX-2 inhibitors, and the numbers are really small. So again, the data was kind of inconclusive. The other piece of this, of course, is that all those drugs have relatively short half-lives, so you can't just take one dose with the levonorgestrel. You have to actually take it for several days after, and that is that's requiring on adherence, which again may result in poor compliance and decreased efficacy. So this study, they came out of Hong Kong, said, well, we have previous studies. They were all small. They, use different non-steroidals. We're going to try and do a larger study that kind of answers this question once and for all. And so it was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study, and they wanted to look at piroxicam. Now, piroxicam, if you're an old man like me, was one of the old non-steroidals that was even hardly barely used when I came out of pharmacy school, painfully about three decades ago. It was hardly used back then, and certainly I haven't seen used in over 20 years now. The reason why is that it because it's a little more COX-1 selective than COX-2, it was always known to have a higher incidence of gastric ulcers, acute kidney injury, and stuff like that. So in the United States, I haven't seen it in 20 years. I had to do a little research. It looks like it is still available in the U.S., I think availability, in individual pharmacies may be a challenge. I'm sure there's only a couple of companies that still make this medication, so cost might be an issue, even though it's been a long generic issue, et cetera, along those, it may be difficult to replicate this in the United States just because piroxicam, even though it's a way old non-steroidal, may be difficult to get just because nobody really uses it anymore. But they picked it because of its really, really long half-life. Its half-life is far longer than, standard non-steroidals that are used in practice. So you would be able to use a single dose of this medication. So that would help with compliance. And of course, quite frankly, help that with them be able to do the study, because they only have to give a single dose of the piroxicam with the 40 milligrams of levonorgestrel. So that's kind of how the study was kind of set up. Again, it was an RCT that was done in Hong Kong conducted by the Family Planning Association, which is, from what I've read, in Hong Kong, one of the big, kind of Planned Parenthood analogs in Hong Kong that helps, provide sexual and reproductive health services, basically. They included people in the study if they had several criteria. First, they had to be healthy and over age 18. Second, they had to request emergency contraception within 72 hours. So emergency contraception in Hong Kong is kind of a behind-the-counter status, where they can ask their pharmacist for it. And basically, if they meet criteria, they get it. So I had requests within 72 hours after a single act of unprotected sexual intercourse in the current menstrual cycle. Third, they had to have fairly regular menstrual cycles between 24 and 42 days long. Fourth, they had to agree to abstain from further acts of unprotected sexual intercourse. And fifth, they had to agree to be available for follow-up so they could take a look at the outcomes. Exclusion criteria included current pregnancy, which would make sense, or breastfeeding, being post-abortion or postpartum and not yet having resumed menstruation. If they have kind of irregular periods and really weren't sure when their last menstrual period had ended, started and ended, if they had an IUD placed or had been either previously sterilized or reporting having a partner being sterilized, that would kind of make sense as well. Those who reported having used hormonal contraception in the current or previous menstrual cycle. And here's where I think that, is going to be a difficulty in the generalization of the study, because they excluded, I think, a fairly large percentage of patients who would probably use Plan B in the United States, who are women who are taking, oral contraceptive pills and either forgot a pill or something along those lines that would make them want to select emergency contraception, basically. So that's kind of a little bit tricky if they were taking non-steroidals in the previous week. And so again, that would make things a little tricky because, I mean, who might not have taken ibuprofen for a headache or something like that in the previous week as well? And then basically a lot of kind of more esoteric stuff. They couldn't currently be on anticoagulants or any medication which would interact with non-steroidals or any drug that would make them more likely to bleed. So like they couldn't be on like I said, anticoagulants or lithium or things along those lines. If they had any history of allergy, they of course were excluded as well. Finally, anyone who reported a history of asthma, urticaria, ischemic heart disease, heart failure, peptic ulcer disease, I mean, basically anything that a non-steroidal might exacerbate were all excluded. I don't think that's that big of a deal because I think the population that's primarily going to use this, I think, tend to be relatively healthy. So I think, again, a single dose of piroxicam is probably unlikely to have any serious adverse effects that you would expect with non-steroidals. At least that's my thought on that. As far as the study, they basically had both pills compounded. Basically, the placebo pills were specifically made by the hilariously named Unicorn Laboratories in Hong Kong. Now that's a lab I want to work for, is Unicorn Laboratories. But basically, they made sure that all the pills basically looked exactly the same. Medications were prepackaged as drug A and B, and then the patients were randomized to receive, group A, which had the emergency contraception and one dose of piroxicam, and the packet that said drug B was the emergency contraception and placebo, basically. When they were recruited in the study, they had to have a negative pregnancy test at baseline. Makes sense. And again, they received a single dose of levonorgestrel, 1.5 milligrams together with piroxicam, or just levonorgestrel by itself, basically. The medications were administered under direct supervision, so that's kind of as good as well. They were then given a diary to measure adverse drug reactions and timing of a return to menses. The primary efficacy outcome was the percentage of pregnancies prevented, as calculated by what's called the Trussell's model. And apparently, this is a standardized way to estimate contraceptive effectiveness. It basically looks at the total number of pregnancies per group as calculated as the average number of expected pregnancies multiplied by the number of efficacy evaluable participants in the group. And then it basically takes a look at what you would expect to be pregnancies based on where in the menstrual cycle they are compared to what actually happened in the study. So kind of interesting. And apparently this is relatively common in contraceptive studies looking at efficacy. So I had not seen that before. I'd done a little research on it, basically. So this was the primary outcome. They also looked at several secondary outcomes, including the date and return of menses. They looked at occurrence of non-menstrual bleeding and then other adverse effects such as nausea, vomiting, things along those lines. They, interestingly, in the study design, did not do a data imputation for missing data. So they didn't do like last observation carried forward. Not really sure if that's a good thing or not, because if you don't have really good follow-up, if you have to kind of make the assumption whether they, if we lost them to follow-up, did they actually become pregnant or not? So this is the kind of study where I think last observation carried forward may not necessarily be the best way to conduct the study. But that's kind of what they did. As far as power is concerned, they wanted to make sure they had enough patients because, again, all the other previous studies had relatively low numbers. Doing their power calculations, they wanted to look to see that at least a 10% increase in efficacy, which is considered clinically meaningful, would have to be targeted. And so they actually had a number of 860 patients in the study, again, far larger than previous studies looking at this. Statistics were pretty standard. Again, nothing really bizarre. They used chi-square test, logistic regression. But interestingly, they did do a couple of subgroup analyses. One was they wanted to look at pre-ovulatory versus post-ovulatory at the time of emergency contraception. And they did that by drawing levels of luteinizing hormone and progesterone and things along those lines to help classify that. And then the second subgroup was body weight. And again, this is, as you might imagine, going to be one of the big generalization problems between a study done in Hong Kong and U.S. patients. And so they used a cutoff of a BMI of 26 or a body weight of 70 kilograms, and they wanted to look at subgroup analysis to see if it was more effective in the first or the second group. So what were these patients? What did they find? And what are the implications, I think, for using emergency contraception? We're going to talk about that at right after a message from our sponsor, CE Impact.
Are you a pharmacist by design? Since we hold a vital position on the healthcare team, it is our responsibility to advance our knowledge and skills so we can provide the best possible care to our patients. Being a pharmacist by design means striving to be the best version of ourselves, not just as professionals, but as individuals dedicated to improving patient outcomes. Learn more about Pharmacists by Design at ceimpact.com. Join us and begin your journey to being the best version of your pharmacist self.
So we are looking at an interesting study published in The Lancet, and as always, we'll have the link to the study in our show notes that looked at adding piroxicam to Plan B to see if it increases the effectiveness of emergency contraception. Again, a study done in Hong Kong, taking a look at the study itself and the baseline characteristics. Average age was 31 in the study with that. And then here's going to be one of the things I think we have to talk about is mean weight was 54 kilograms. And so body mass index in this study was 21, which again, I think may hamper some of the generalizability. Only about 10% of patients in the study actually had weights over 70 kilograms or had a BMI greater than 26. So take that for what you will. As far as ethnicity, the overwhelming number of patients were Chinese, as you might imagine from a study done in Hong Kong. Time from intercourse to being enrolled and being in the study was 18 hours. So I think pretty good there. And again, keeping in mind that these patients were pretty much seen right away and given emergency contraception right away. About a 40% of both both arms had been pregnant previously, with about 31% given birth in patients. So about a third of these patients had given birth previously. As far as the reason for emergency contraception, the overwhelming number reason was condom failure, though there were some other numbers as well. So then we use this Trussell's method to kind of figure out the objective versus observed. So looking at this patient, this cohort, looking at when they could have expected to be pregnant in the placebo group, they figured that the observed rate of pregnancy, and again, this was just in patients who received levonorgestrel, was 1.7%. So 1.7% is what they actually saw as far as people who were just on the levonorgestrel. When they added piroxicam, it actually dropped to 0.2%. Now you may say, well, that's not that big of a deal, but the expected pregnancies really kind of tells the tale here. So the expected pregnancy rate would be 19%. So if the patients weren't taking emergency contraception at all, the expected pregnancy rate would be about 4.6%. So what that means then is if in just the emergency contraceptive group, you go from 4.6% to 1.7%, and in the piroxicam group and Plan B, you go from 4.6% to 0.2%. So when you add all that up, the proportion of pregnancies prevented in the levonorgestrel group was about 65%. And the proportion of pregnancies prevented in the piroxicam group was 95%. So significantly higher than they even estimated in their power calculations. And as you might imagine, that was very statistically significant. So, the numbers themselves may not seem all that high, but again, taking a look at this, it dramatically increased the proportion of pregnancies prevented in the study. So, that seemed to be pretty effective there. As far as average drug reactions, they actually didn't find that much of a difference between the two groups. There was no difference in stomach issues or nausea and vomiting, stomach pain, things along those lines. In the sample, they note that there was a very small percentage of patients who had a BMI of over 26. They noted that no group in either category were pregnant in this category. So again, that does make me a little nervous about blanket recommending this combination, because unfortunately in this study, the number of patients with a BMI over 26 was so small and none of them became pregnant in either group. It becomes very difficult to extrapolate the overall data to women who might have a higher BMI. So that's just worth noting, I think. About 138 women agreed to have the blood taken for hormonal assays. So even though they wanted to take a look at pre versus post ovulation, they had such a small number of patients that they basically abandoned that and said they decided not to do it. So overall, it seemed to be about equally well tolerated. There didn't seem to be any significant increase in side effects. Return of menses was actually similar between groups as well. So again, nothing along those lines. And again, an increase of proportion of pregnancies prevented that, again, I would say about 25%. So, the author's comment that it seemed to be, you know, associated with an increased risk of or increased efficacy at preventing pregnancies, but not an increased risk of adverse drug reactions, including no disturbances to menstrual patterns. They do note, again, as we've talked about in the pod, that there were several generalizability issues. Again, most of these patients had a BMI below 26. So again, that might be difficult to translate. They also note that they excluded patients who had current hormonal contraception. And again, I think that's going to be a little bit tricky, especially in places like the United States where oral contraception is actually pretty common. So I think that's, you know, those are some issues which I think may limit the generalizability of this data. But I'm not sure a bigger study is ever going to be done in this. I'm kind of dismayed that, again, they did not include patients, women who are on hormonal contraception, just because, again, that's so common in most of the Western world. Looking at the population, I'm not really surprised they had an overall lower number of patients who were obese. And so, again, we know that obesity decreases the efficacy of emergency contraception. So, again, that makes things a little difficult as well. But I mean, I'm hoping that this might be a nice baseline to actually take a look at this combination use, if for no other reason in patients who do fit the parameters of the study. So if you had a patient who wanted emergency contraception, was not currently on hormonal contraception, and again, had required or would like emergency contraception because of condom failure or something like that, and especially if their BMI is less than 26, I think that this data is pretty compelling and I think pretty strong in a pretty well-done study. So the question becomes, how does this happen? Emergency contraception, can be basically requested, whereas piroxicam would require a prescription. So that's going to make things a little tricky in the United States. Do you have separate pills that you give at one time? Will some, ambitious drug company decide, based on this, they'll come up with some sort of combo pill that you take at one time that, of course, they can charge $1 million for? I hope not. But that's certainly, I could see that possibility occurring as well. So I think, the bottom line is it's a fascinating study. And I think it proves, kind of for the first time, that adding nonsteroidals does seem to enhance the efficacy of emergency contraception. Now the implementation becomes the hard part, and how can we translate this, especially in the United States, to the patients, I think, who fit the parameters of the study, as well as making it as convenient as possible. We know that convenience and ease of access is one of the key factors in using emergency contraception. And while I'm very interested in these outcomes, if anything adds significant barriers to accessing emergency contraception and decreases uptake by the women who would like to have it, that becomes, I think, somewhat problematic in trying to apply this data, especially in the United States. So that's it for this week of Game Changers. Thanks for listening again. That's it for this week. I do want to mention that many of you know I'm a producer of house music under the name Prophet of Jupiter, and I was very fortunate to have a couple of singles released on Electric Eden, the Electric Eden house label. You can actually listen to that anywhere you get music. So Spotify, YouTube, Apple Music, et cetera, et cetera. Please give it a listen and see what you think, and shoot me an email if you like what you hear. Anyway, we'll see you next week. Remember that time flies. I don't know where it's going, but the most important day is today. We'll see you then.
Jen here. Be sure to check out our education at ceimpact.com. You'll find it to be your one-stop shop for all the CE resources you need. Become a Pharmacist by Design member today to access it all for free, including CE for this podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week on Game Changers Clinical Conversations.